everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode 230. I am Patrick Gray. This week's show is short and sweet. We'll be chatting with Alistair McGibbon, who's heading up Crest Australia. He's the chief executive of Crest Australia, and that, of course, stands for the Council of Registered Ethical Security Testers. It's a new organisation in Australia, anyway, that has the support of the federal government and funding from the Attorney General. But what's the point of these certifications and registrations? Is the problem that we face in the security industry a lack of reliable accreditation, or is it more about the lack of genuinely skilled people out there? That discussion with Alistair McGibbon is coming up soon. But before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. Now, Adam, it's been a while since we've had one of these, but we've got a legit little planet melter on our hands in the form of the latest bug patched by Microsoft. We've got a remote pre-auth in RDP. Goody, goody, goody.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, hasn't it? I mean, we haven't seen a bug this juicy in a number of years, and I mean, a bug in any kind of Microsoft Network Listening Protocol pre-auth is a big deal, and RDP especially, given that the components run in kernel space. It's a very privileged process, very likely to be exposed to the internet, very widely used amongst all the very hip cloud people for deploying their infrastructure as a service. Up in the cloud and getting the console. So yeah, it's a big deal, and Microsoft are rating this critical, likely to be exploited. and they said, well, likely to be exploited in the next 30 days, and judging by the activity on the Twitters in the last few days, it's likely to see working exploit in about 10 minutes.
Yeah, well, given practically everyone I know who is want to do these sorts of things basically just disappeared as soon as the bulletin came out.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they disappeared into a bloody into a nice dark room with a crate of Red Bull to try to reverse it. I think I've spoken to about five people just myself who've been working on it, so I think the likelihood of it being exploited is somewhat likely.
Yeah, it's very likely, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to be completely straightforward. I mean, there's loads of smart people working on it, and we haven't yet seen it turn into the next SASA, a slammer or something. But I mean, it's definitely looking like a wormable bug, and somebody might write it up and sell it via Canvas or whatever, and somebody else may write it up and turn it into the next
Internet weapon.
Yeah, exactly. Beat me to it. Jeez.
Internet weapon.
For those of you out there who are confused by that little clip that I just threw in there, that is actually from an interview I did with Eugene Kaspersky himself at OSCERT many years ago. That is actually Eugene. That's how he says internet weapon. but yes, RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol, big time flaw. But the thing that I love about this industry is that, when there's potential for real mayhem, people do get a little bit excited, don't they? They're like, start going, ooh, goody.
Especially all us Unix guys who, it's nice to see somebody else getting owned for a change.
Yeah, we don't see too many of these in DOS these days.
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty big deal bug. And certainly if you've got RDP in your environment, then really, filter it at the border at the very least.
Well, it's patched, isn't it, this thing?
It did get patched, but I mean, there's a you really do have to roll that patch out pretty quick because everybody's looking like there's been a big uptick, of course, in RDP scanning. I noticed it come past a bunch of the boxes I look after.
Maybe someone does have an exploit.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of dodgy proof of concept exploits turning up on paste bins, etc.
Ones that are going to RMRF your drive, just like the good old days.
there's one attributed to Sabu at FBI.gov, which was pretty funny.
Nice. Yes, so I guess the people feeling the impact from this bug most at the moment are all the skiddies who are currently having their boxes RMRF'd by dodgy exploits.
Yeah, exactly. Got to be careful out there, people.
Now, you mentioned Sabu just a moment ago, and this, of course, is the Lulzsec leader who'd been flipped by the FBI as far back as June last year. Now, it turned out he was a rather enthusiastic little informant.
Yeah, by the sounds of the stories, he was really getting into this whole being a snitch thing. maybe it's part of the hacker mindset. If you get a license to own stuff because all of a sudden you're a snitch, then maybe you're just going to really go to town and make the most of it as the making hay while the FBI shine or something.
There's been a couple of interesting little timelines of his behavior and like what sort of happened with Lulzsec and Antisec and stuff like that while he was actually working with the FBI. Documents have also revealed that he was able to convince the other sort of Lulzsec guys to store Stratfor information on a server owned by the FBI. Now, I understand, and it was just my reading of this document that I saw sort of on the net, it was my understanding that this enabled Stratfor to recover some data that the intruders had actually deleted. So pretty smart strategy from the FBI there.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of offsite FBI data recovery backup process sounds...
The FBI, now with cloud.
Certainly sounds like the way of the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, FBI cloud storage. Sounds pretty good. Admin
just
by...
Just like Dropbox, except cheaper.
Admin by, you know, like fairly well-skilled snitches. I don't think this guy was the best hacker in the world, but you'd probably trust him to admin a storage box, wouldn't you?
Well, yeah, he certainly seems to be able to collect a fair amount of data, so yeah, perhaps so. You can always, you know, store it in Sony's cloud.
Oh, that'll be funny if that ever happens. Now, now, staying with all things anonymous now, and there's been some Muppet has come up with a Linux distro called Anonymous OS. Now, who in their right mind is going to use it?
Well, exactly, and this has been a particularly funny story. These jerks... started up like a Tumblr feed and a SourceForge project with essentially what is just an Ubuntu 11.10 desktop box with a bunch of hacker tools pre-installed, and they've been redistributing this as a bootable ISO and calling it Anonymous OS with pretty desktop backgrounds of
Guy Fawkes masks
in masks. Man, what a joke, hey? And of course, people have, other anonymous people have been attempting to distance themselves from these, as you say, Muppets. And indeed, it's actually got as far as SourceForge now have pulled their project for, quote, lack of transparency, unquote. But yeah, really, like don't download your operating system from some random guy on the internet and just run it. That would be a bad plan.
That would be like running some sort of exploit you found on Pastebin.
Yeah, exactly. Downloading Loic based on instructions you saw on Pastebin.
It's funny, you know, Pastebin and Twitter are the new full disclosure, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. I mean, yeah, you're right. Full disclosure is, the list itself is dead. But, Tumblr and Twitter do seem to have taken over a bit.
Now, speaking of Anonymous doing stupid shit, this story is a great story. I really think this is a very, very interesting story about the whole concept of Anonymous. Because this bloke has been arrested in the UK. He's like a anti-abortionist hacker. Now, this is sort of the thing. I mean, you tend to associate Anonymous with libertarian ideology. And here you've got some guy who's like anti-choice under the banner of Anonymous, breaking into an abortion clinic and stealing the details of women who've been to that clinic either for, termination procedures or counseling and stuff like that. I mean, this is a very interesting little turn of events, isn't it? Because I can't imagine that most Anonymous members would agree with this person's stance.
Yeah, it does go against the sort of, general thing you would expect to come out of people identifying with Anonymous. And I think it's interesting that this particular article said self-proclaimed member of Anonymous, like there's some other kind of member of Anonymous. But yeah, like that, using that kind of language to sort of distance it from what we expect I've come to expect from regular Anonymous people. But it's an interesting turn of events. And really does underscore the extent to which, Anonymous is just a banner that says, I'm doing something, and furthermore, I would like some publicity about it.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Yeah. Well, this guy got caught, thankfully. I mean, I just think it's pretty appalling to target that sort of information. I don't believe that he actually published it, but he did publish an administrator's login, which would have enabled other people to access that information. I mean, that's just appalling. You got to hope this guy gets some time in the clink. He's based in the UK, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it really is pretty bad targeting people who are, kind of that vulnerable. That's, it's a pretty shit thing that, you would really struggle to find anyone who would think that was a good idea.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the problem with a quote-unquote organization that anyone can join and no one can be kicked out of. You wind up with a organization
right.
full. You wind up with a brand with a lot of douchebags associated with it, essentially.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly what's happening, right? Mm. I mean, every man and his dog is, who wants to be a dick on the internet is, donning the mask and off they go.
Yeah, well, I wonder, as a sensible, say you were part of some intelligence agency that was tasked with sort of making Anonymous uncool, it wouldn't be that hard. You'd just keep doing douchebaggy stuff like this, and you'd eventually dilute the brand to the point where it didn't represent those sorts of libertarian ideals anymore, and people wouldn't associate with it.
Man, it sounds like you could work for Palantir with ideas like that, man.
Yeah, that's right. We could form, Themis 2. Those guys, man. Talking about douchebags on the internet.
Talking about douchebags, yeah. Turbo douchebags.
Now, here's a really interesting piece that came to us via Secure Computing Magazine Australia. It's a great piece. Turns out these military guys, like some American soldiers in Iraq in 2007, took some happy snaps of some Apache helicopters being delivered to their base and then, you know, published them on their Facebook profile or whatever. Now, the enemy found these, got the geotagging information, and used it to launch a precise mortar strike on the exact location of these Apaches and destroy them. I mean, we're talking about millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions worth of very expensive, shiny military hardware, brand new, mind you, destroyed.
Yeah, it's an interesting story, isn't it? Because, I mean, the idea that this would happen, that, you know, the whole overall story seems very believable. But the thing that really is interesting here is that they have the capability to find that intelligence and act upon it with, you know, sufficient speed to make good use of it, which is something that, you know, the conventional militaries really struggle with. Right. I mean, you know, the US military is spending, you know, about millions of billions of dollars on building battlefield information systems and communication systems to try and be able to do exactly this. And the fact that insurgents can manage to pull this together with significantly less resourcing and, you know, very effectively, you know, it really does say something about, I suppose, the asymmetry of modern warfare.
Yeah, although, I mean, I would imagine there are many, many people working for Western militaries who are tasked with looking for that sort of information. I mean, whether they're from, you know, various signals intelligence arms of militaries or NSA or, in our case, Defense Signals Directorate or whatever, you know, you're gonna, I would be very surprised if our militaries weren't using those similar tactics. But it does tend to suggest, I mean, this, as I mentioned earlier, this happened in 2007, but it does tend to suggest that this isn't the work of some disorganized militia. These guys would almost certainly be, you know, it suggests command structure, doesn't it? It suggests ex-military types and some pretty solid thinking.
Well, yeah, it does. It's just a level of organization and, I suppose, sophistication in thinking that, you know, you would imagine that some people don't necessarily associate with insurgencies. And, you know, this is obviously a very good counterexample of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, moving back into some more conventional InfoSec news. Now, that little wildcard scenario that we discussed on the show last week, that someone might turn up to, or was it a couple of weeks ago, that someone might actually turn up to CanSec West, you know, some unknown teenager might just turn up and drop some O'Day on the Ponium contest. It actually happened. This guy, Pinkie Pie, came along and scored himself 60K by exploiting the Chrome browser and punching through the sandbox. So we've seen two successful entries, both collecting 60 grand from doing that.
Yeah, I was very resoundingly wrong, wasn't I? Saying that no one would turn up for that kind of money. And yeah, your theory of, you know, a teenager in his bedroom for whom 60K would be a quite lovely amount of cash is exactly what happened. This guy, Pinkie Pie, turned up, I gather it's some kind of, he had a sandbox escape and then some kind of bug, I believe, in the GPU rendering stuff that, you know, led to, you know, full code exec sandbox escape and everything, and he collected the money, which, you know, good for him. And the story goes that he had apparently submitted his CV to Google some time ago to work on the
security
team.
And they never even bothered getting back to him.
Yeah, I guess they're getting back to him now, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I had a similar thing where there's a young guy here in Australia who had submitted his resume to a large InfoSec company, and they told him that he didn't have a degree, so they wouldn't consider him. Yeah, I wound up placing him with another company, and he's really good, actually, like, you know, kind of freaky good.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, those are the people you got to find, and clearly it says something about Google's hiring processes that they didn't, you know, recognize that and grab it until now. But on the other hand, right, I mean, he's doing well. He's got 60K up, and you know, clearly has a good future ahead of him.
I bet they want to give him a job now, don't they?
I bet they do.
Yeah. Now, speaking of, you know, Pinkie Pie, he's named after what is it? It's like some little cartoon or something.
Apparently it's a My Little Pony character. It's a pony in My Little Pony, and the pony fan community, who are called bronies, apparently. Are very, very pleased that one of their ponies in arms has been so successful in defeating Google and the internet at large using their pony power. So I've been reading some of the follow-up amongst the pony fanpic community, and they're very proud indeed.
Yeah, this guy doesn't use his own name because apparently he didn't have authorization from his employer to actually enter the contest and stuff like that. So, but yeah, Pinkie Pie, he's got his own little logo, which is this like My Little Pony holding a gigantic axe, which is kind of cool, I got to say.
They're a strange bunch, man, those My Little Pony fanfic people, though. It's, yeah, I don't know if I'd necessarily want to associate myself with them.
Now, it has been a pretty quiet news week, but this final item that we're going to finish off with is borderline hilarious. A whole bunch of prosecutors working on the WikiLeaks case, or the prosecution of Bradley Manning, alleging that he was the WikiLeaks source. They've encountered some technical issues that have held up their prosecution.
Yeah, apparently they've been just, not receiving email for some strange reason. And then, after a month or two had elapsed and the prosecutors were embarrassed at not having received communication from the court about the case, they discovered that, of course, being federal government employees, they can't get emails with the word WikiLeaks in them.
La 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 la.
Yeah, exactly. So now they have to go and like dig them out of their quarantine box or something to be able to read emails about their case.
But I just love it that that's such like dumb admin thinking, which is like, or it could even be dumb policy from up on high, which is, we'll just block anything with the word WikiLeaks. Problem solved.
There, I fixed it.
Yeah, exactly. There, I fixed it. It's done. Well, Adam, as I mentioned, it is a short news segment this week. There's not a lot actually to cover. I think everyone's having a little post-RSA rest and getting over their hangovers, of which there were plenty. I've spoken to a few people who've returned home since, and they had fun.
Yeah, although I hear the CA's keynote didn't go down quite so well.
Ah, that was quite funny. Did you see the Twitters lighting up over that?
I did see the Twitters. They lit up real good.
Yeah, I thought of you.
nothing quite like CA making dicks of themselves in public that warms the cockles of my heart.
You're a happy beardy guy.
I am.
Okay, mate. Well, thank you very much. And as usual, we'll chat to you again next week.
See you then, Pat.
Adam Boileau with a look at the week's news headlines there. And before we continue, I would like to congratulate my very close friend, and sometime risky business guest, Adam Poynton. I'd like to congratulate him and his wife on the birth of their first child, baby Ava. I'm absolutely stoked for both of you, and it'll be very nice to have three of my favourite people living under one roof instead of just two. Cigars all round. Very happy for both of you. Okay, it's time for this week's feature interview now with Alastair McGibbon, the Chief Executive of Crest Australia, the Council of Registered Ethical Security Testers. In the UK, Crest is kind of a big deal, sort of like a Ron Burgundy. And now it's on its way to Australia and New Zealand. And I think there's a similar organisation in the USA that is doing things the Crest way. So this could actually become a worldwide accepted accreditation for security testers. And I know what you're thinking. CISP, right? But no, I mean, I know at least one extremely capable penetration tester who flew over to the UK to take the Crest tests, and he wound up flunking the team leader / managerial portion of one of them. So they're not really your typical rubber stamp. They've got a bit of teeth to them. But the question has to be, with such a lack of talented security testers out there, it seems entirely plausible, from where I sit anyway, that Crest Australia will have to lower its standards to get enough people certified. And security also is such a fast-moving discipline. How will qualifications or accreditations like these ensure that certified testers actually have current skills? I mean, is there a point to doing this? So to discuss this, Crest Australia Chief Executive Alastair McGibbon joined me by phone for this chat.
There was certainly a need in Australia for some form of market differentiation between the various people touting services in the IT security space. So Crest is really two things the way I see it. One is that the companies that join Crest aspire to and sign up to certain standards on how they operate. And that's yet to be fully defined, by the way, by the board. So it's hard for me to say exactly what those standards will be, apart from the fact that companies will subscribe to those standards and live up to them, and if they don't, then they'll be expelled from Crest. And then there's the concept of the operators, the technical people that work within those companies, and a testing regime and an accreditation regime to say Patrick Gray passed this particular accreditation, this test. And, it's regarded as a pretty tough test by many people. And so really good security testers might expect to fail the first time possibly, or they might pass. But, experience in the UK shows, and Australians have gone to the UK to do the testing, have shown that, you can be pretty good at your job and still fail this test. So the aim is it's quite aspirational. It's not for everyone. And it doesn't mean if you don't have Crest accreditation that you're not good and that you're not ethical. I mean, that's a really important point to make. No one is claiming that Crest is the only organisation that holds the torch on what's good and right and technically skilled people. Like any testing regime, it's never going to be a perfect reflection of a person's skills. And, you know, the aim is to create some form of differentiation, primarily because it's my firm belief and my experience that the companies that buy these services and usually pay pretty good money for them don't often know what it is they're getting. Now, I can't think of many other markets in our economy where you fork out good money for not actually knowing necessarily what you're getting, and certainly not knowing whether or not the people doing the job have signed up to certain standards. So, for example, you get a house built, you get someone that's got a master builder's gold ticket. You get a plumber in, and you they have to have some form of qualification. This is not the same as those, but it's moving towards the concept of saying if someone's going to do these types of tests and this type of protection for your company, then this is what you'd expect from them. So the test isn't just about your skill in IT security and penetration testing. It's also about how you communicate what you find back to the customer. And that's a very important thing.
Yeah, no, I understand there's, the reporting element. There's even tests on the reporting elements for Crest. Now, am I correct in understanding that in the UK there are certain types of jobs that are only open to people who hold a Crest accreditation?
Well, certainly the Crest UK guys will tell you that people with Crest qualifications tend to find jobs faster, and it might well be that certain industries will say we will only accept Crest accredited people to do the job. And I, again, think that's a good thing. So one of my roles will be to work with various parts of the customer base to argue why a Crest accreditation is either a preferred thing for them to be purchasing, or maybe it's the standard that they set, the gold standard that they set in whatever field of business it is, to say, look, if you're going to be getting testing done, get it done by a Crest accredited company, a Crest member company with Crest accredited the security testers. And look, none of these regimes are exclusionary, and none of them prevent anyone else or group of people from creating a different standard or a different set of tests. It is very much a free market, so no one's imposing this upon people. But what they are saying is you have to draw a line in the sand somewhere. You have to make a decision to say, well, let's pick a standard and then let's make that standard worth something. So, the way it works in the UK, as far as I can see, is that people with Crest accreditation tend to get jobs faster. They can often charge more money associated with it because they can actually have a demonstrable accreditation. And that certain types of industries and businesses prefer to buy from Crest member companies with Crest accredited security testers. So it should be a good thing for the industry. But just like any other sector of business, there will be plenty of good quality firms that may choose not to be part of Crest. And testers that may think it's not worthwhile, just as some people would choose not to go and get higher qualifications at university, because they can prove they're smart and good at their job in other ways.
Don't you think we run the risk, though, of creating a group of people who are going to rest on their accreditation laurels? I mean, how long do these accreditations stay valid? Because, as we know, security, particularly technical security testing, is a very fast-moving target. I mean, just because someone's been accredited today doesn't mean that in 5 or 10 years from now they're going to have relevant skills.
Sure.
Is this sure?
My dad's an engineer, and he did engineering clearly before I was born, and he can still practice as an engineer because he did a university degree in the 50s or whatever it was. The reality is that there are many more doctors. Let's talk about them. Now, there's concepts of continuing education and other such things, which we'll probably look at. But you need to, at some point, draw a line in the sand and say, here's a testing regime. Let's see how you go in it. Now, Crest accreditation will probably last for 2 years, which means you resit the exam for that length of time. But the board hasn't made the decision yet, so so that's not obviously locked in concrete, but that would seem to be reasonably good practice. You don't want people either spending the money or the huge amount of time it takes for these things to study up and to actually sit the exam on an annual basis. But, you know, there might be some continuing education or other things we can look at. So there's never going to be a perfect regime. And, yes, if people rest on their laurels to say, I've got this accreditation, therefore I'm so good I can do any job, well, you know, you're going to pick that in the person. They've got to demonstrate when they go for contracts, you know, what their last jobs were. So it is about just making sure that you do what you can to measure some form of skill set, that you have a uniform testing regime so you can compare people against that skill set, and you know, do your best to promote that skill set to the broader market. So you do need to make it relevant, but you also need to make it achievable by by enough people to make a marketplace.
This is an interesting thing, okay? Because it's long been my opinion that what we need isn't better accreditation. What we need are more people who are good at this stuff. Okay, so it's my fear that under a regime like this, you're going to need to, in order to attract sufficient numbers in to actually make it a viable accreditation regime, you're going to have to water it down a little bit.
Well, it's not about lowering standards, making it easy. It's about helping people get to a higher standard.
How does an accreditation regime actually do that?
Well,
I mean, that's more of an education proposition than an accreditation and testing proposition.
And Crest in the UK does not provide education on how to get. They don't help you. They don't teach to the test. And I think that's an important thing. There are other places people can go to skill up. People will theoretically at least, study for this type of thing, and they'll hopefully work hard to get to the accreditation. But again, there does need to be a rational sort of line drawn somewhere. So you're never going to have a world where everyone is, the pristine, best person in the world, or else no one else is, of course. So, one of the observations I would make about this particular industry is there are a lot of people who spend a lot of time denigrating each other's skills. They're all the smartest person in the room, and that's great. But perhaps what we need to be doing is saying, well, what are the standards that we think are acceptable and good and sound and robust? Let's build testing regimes around those. Let's not say that it's the be-all and end-all, because we all know it's not. As you say, it's got a lot to do with just being good at it. But just being good at it is not enough for a customer, because how does the customer know? Put yourself in the shoes of a big publicly listed company who doesn't really know what it is they're buying. They know they've got to have one, but they don't know what one looks like. So if you just go to them and say, I'm Patrick Gray, I'm really good at this stuff, oh, great, that's a really good marketing pitch. But if you can say, I'm Patrick Gray, I'm really good at this stuff, and I have these accreditations that are internationally recognised, that are reasonably uniform across Australia, the UK, and wherever else,
But hang on, then you're relying on that person. I mean, what's to stop them seeing CISP and saying, wow, you've got a CISP, that's great. How is the person in this scenario supposed to be able to differentiate between the qualities of each competing qualification?
Yeah, look, there is no answer to that apart from saying that this then does come down to what Crest, the organisation, does to show why a Crest accreditation, and why it's not just the individual but the company they work for that's important. And I think that's an important differentiation.
So that's when you've got to do your roadshow and be very, very impressive.
Well, that's where Crest needs to say, here's the difference. And I don't think they're mutually exclusive things either. I don't think anyone would ever suggest that. I'm sure no other regime would say it's the only one for everyone, and therefore what I'm saying is one of the key points of difference in Crest is A, considered to be reasonably tough when it comes to the actual examination side, but no examination is perfect, and it's not a perfect reflection of people's skills. I acknowledge that. I think any rational person would. But the other interesting thing about Crest is it also looks at the companies themselves that are members of Crest. And that's important too, because you're not just buying Patrick Gray, you're probably buying Patrick Gray and the company he works for.
Well, you wouldn't want to do that, because you might wind up with a podcast and not a very well-tested network.
That's right, but a good podcast nonetheless, Patrick.
The flattery will get you everywhere, Alex.
Oh, thank you.
The other question too is this: I believe this whole project was kicked off with a bit of funding from the Attorney General's Department. Why is the government funding this? Why is the government interested in this at all?
Well, I think the government sees the relevance in actually starting to put some form of differentiation in this particular market. And that's because there is government needs to sit in terms of securing computers and systems that are nationally important, because not all of them, as we know, are actually owned by the government. In fact, increasingly, they're owned and have for quite some time been in the private sector. So the government has an interest in making sure that there is some ability for the private sector, when it buys these services, to differentiate between the providers of the service. Now, again, nothing's perfect. Nothing's ever going to give you a complete reflection of professionalism. But what it will do is it'll give you an ability to start making a rational purchasing decision as a perhaps a victim of an intrusion, or a company that wants to protect itself against future intrusions.
This is hinting at something that you said earlier, which is that it's not just about pen testing. I understand there might be a bit of an incident response element to Crest Australia.
Well, Crest UK does more than penetration testing, and that's why I said originally, what's in a name? I mean, so the name reflects where Crest started. It doesn't necessarily reflect where Crest will end up.
So are there different qualifications? Like, you can have a different accreditation, I'm a qualified incident responder or a qualified penetration tester, that sort of stuff.
So in the UK, there are several exams and several sort of levels of accreditation that people can receive. Some of it's linear and some of it's in parallel. But the key point is that in Australia, we're starting from nothing and we're building from nothing. What we do have is a close relationship with the organisation in the UK, and we're in the process of talking to them about how to bring their testing regimes into Australia, but making sure, of course, that they're relevant for the Australian market, both socially and legislatively, because, threats aren't actually uniform globally. We do see differences geographically in the types of attacks that occur and the types of problems that companies find. So we need to make sure that these testing regimes are relevant to the Australian marketplace, just as New Zealand, when they stand up Crest, which clearly they're looking at doing, that they make sure it's relevant to the New Zealand market as well. So, I don't think we're ever going to see a situation where these are global regimes. They might well be in time, or international regimes, but they will be, I think, pretty in line with each other, at least at first, and we'll see where we end up in terms of a couple of years' time, whether there are agreed standards globally or other such things.
Okay, Alastair McGibbon, thank you so much for taking some time out of your no doubt hectic schedule to have a bit of a chat about Crest Australia.
Cheers, Patrick. Thanks very much.
Al McGibbon, the Chief Executive of Crest Australia there, and he's also the Director of the Centre for Internet Safety. There is no sponsor interview this week. If your company is interested in sponsoring the Risky Business Podcast, please email me, patrick@risky.biz. This track is called Pepper Snake, and it's by the Cactus Channel, who are based out of Melbourne. It is available through Hope Street Recordings on vinyl or as an MP3 online. And I'm pretty sure you can get it either from Hope Street's site or just grab it on iTunes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.